Good evening, everybody. Welcome to the November 2025 book launch for Behind Our Eyes. Tonight, we have a special guest and author, Sue Bird Sparrow, and we're going to talk about her and her book, The Devil Drinks Monsoons. I have a little bit to say about Sue, and then we're going to get started. Susan Sparrow is a visually impaired author, dreamer, an extroverted introvert, living out her current incarnation in human form in New Orleans while working on her next novel. When not writing, Susan can be found memorizing drinking toasts in diverse languages or transcribing the epic poems whispered by her companion tortoise, Gordon Ramsay. The Devil Drinks Monsoons is her debut novel. And she could be found at SueBirdWrites.com. And also, you can find more about Sue and her writing on her Amazon author page. Welcome, Sue. How are you tonight?
Hi, Annie. I'm great. Thank you so much for interviewing me.
Oh, you're welcome. It's a pleasure to have you here. And I really enjoyed your book. It made me laugh in spots, and the characters really drew me in. And I just got to say, did you have fun writing it? Because it sounds like you had fun writing it.
I had so much fun. That's the only reason I would do it. If it wasn't, I mean, there's nobody holding a gun to my head. So, if it wasn't fun, I don't do things these days.
Oh, I understand. Yeah. If it doesn't make me money or make me happy, I don't do it, right? So,
Yes. Well, writing will
but
not make us rich, right?
it
So
makes us happy. If it
it
makes
makes
us feel
us happy.
satisfied. Who is the publisher of your book? Could you tell us a little bit about them and how you connected with them?
So that's actually a funny story. I had been submitting The Devil Drinks Monsoons to a lot of different publishers, and I kept getting either rejections or just, it goes off into the void and you don't hear anything back. And I had submitted it to about 50 different publishers when, in the space of 2 days, I got two contracts. And one was with Pelican Publishing here in New Orleans, and the other was with a small press called Bayou Wolf Press in Alabama. And they both sent me contracts, and I looked them over, and I had a lot of questions about the one from Pelican. And we talked about it, and we were not really seeing eye to eye on a lot of things. So then I went over the contract from Bayou Wolf, and I had a couple of questions, and I got them on the phone, and they spoke to me, and we worked everything out immediately. And I felt so comfortable that I actually went with the small press rather than Pelican. And I haven't regretted a day of it. They've been wonderful.
Wow, that's a wonderful story. Oh, I'm curious about what are some of the things that you felt trepidatious about with Pelican? Like, what didn't you feel worked for you?
I hesitate to go into any kind of detail because I don't want
Yeah,
to.
no, only general stuff is fine. We don't want you to.
Because they're a very nice press, and I'm leaving the door open with them for one of my next works, but we were not able to see eye to eye on things like royalty percentages
I
and
see.
the basic things
Yeah.
like that.
I understand. Okay. Well, that's something for people here tonight to understand that you have choices, and you were able to make a decision that benefited you in the end. And I think that's sometimes we think we have to go with what we have. But we don't have to. And you just proved
No.
that. Yeah.
Yeah, and I think it's really important. I mean, we put our heart and soul into this work and we labor over it for so long, and then we're just going to take the first offer that comes by? No. I would rather hold it and wait for the right situation to occur. And luckily for me, it showed up immediately.
Wonderful. So could you give us a little bit about background about your writing and how long you've been writing, maybe?
Sure.
Yeah.
So prior to this, I had written a memoir that was about the journey of my diagnosis with birdshot retinochoroidopathy and the slowly losing my vision situation. And I really had only written short stories prior to that. And it was like therapy for me, actually. It was a badly written book. It was depressing. It was angry. It was a lot of bad things. And the book now lives in a desk drawer where it will continue to stay. But it did serve a great purpose in that I got it out of my system. I was able to come to grips with my situation and what was happening to me. And I was able to hone my writing skills on that book. And I really don't think I would have been able to write this one if I hadn't done that first.
Yeah. How old were you when you were diagnosed, if you don't mind me asking?
I was 50.
And you lived as a sighted person until then?
Yes. I wore
Yeah.
glasses, but that was it. And I had just moved by myself into a log cabin in upstate New York when I was diagnosed. So that was pretty terrifying because the prognosis is gradual vision loss with what I call cliffs and plateaus. I'll suddenly lose some vision and then it'll stabilize for a little while before suddenly losing more. So it was difficult for me to wrap my head around this constant readjusting to my situation. And it's like, you're grieving all over again every time you lose more vision. But I think I've got a handle on it now. I'm just grateful for what I can do now.
So progressive vision loss and living in a cabin, I just think that's probably the most contrary type of thing that could happen. How did you handle that?
Not well.
Did you move back after? Did you stay in the cabin? I mean, I'm just my curiosity is going crazy here.
I did stay in the cabin for 12 years, up until I had to take an early retirement because I used to I was a recruiter for a major insurance company. I used to recruit dental professionals, and I had to drive all over New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut. And one day I realized that there's no way I can get in the car again. I'm going to kill myself or I'm going to kill somebody. And I turned in my resignation, I retired, and I moved to New Orleans, which is where I had always thought I would retire. And I just landed here a little early. And it was the best thing that ever happened to me. I love it here. And I can get around without a car. They have streetcars, they have Ubers. And, just a huge social scene that I did not have living alone in a cabin in upstate New York. So I kind of went from one extreme to the other, but I love it.
That's wonderful. It's wonderful. Are you going to ever write about all of this and in this transitory path
Well,
to
I don't know that I would do another autobiography. I don't I feel like I'm done with that, and I don't like to dwell, and I don't like really talking about myself, to be honest.
Okay. Well,
Another contradictory thing, because here I am on an interview, right?
yeah, right. I know. I'm sorry. I don't mean to make you feel
No,
uncomfortable.
I wasn't saying that you
I
did.
just
I have put myself in this position.
Okay. So why horror? Why paranormal? Why these type of stories? What do you
Well,
bring to them from your experiences in real life?
that also is kind of contradictory because I cannot watch horror movies, slasher movies, anything like that. I don't like blood and guts or gore. I don't like really even reading about graphic things like that. And yet I can write it with abandon.
Yes.
I'm not sure why, but it doesn't bother me to write it. As long as, so the book does have some gruesome parts to it, but it's always tongue in cheek, and there's always some humor behind it. And I think that's what makes it attractive for me. I can be outrageous, but I'm not making myself gag.
Yes, I re distinctly remember one part where one character was feasting on a human bone, and I was like, "Ah, she did!" I was like grossed out, but then I wasn't grossed out so much that I couldn't continue reading. So I
Right.
think that's what you mean. Yeah. That was a very good scene, by the way. Oh my goodness. So. Why you said you have a couple of excerpts that you'd like to read. So if you're ready, why don't you read one for us?
Okay, I can do that.
Excellent.
So this actually is chapter one from The Devil Drinks Monsoons. Wandering among the mausoleums of St. Louis Cemetery No. 1, the young couple sipped from large white go cups emblazoned with port of call. The sun beat down as they stumbled on the broken concrete paths between the grave sites. Beth pointed, "Look at this, Medalise Chanson Duvalier. What a great name, huh?" She sucked on her straw, slurping up the sticky red liquid in a futile attempt to stay cool. The last of the ice had melted 20 minutes ago. "It's kind of hot for this right now, hon. No wonder we've got the whole place to ourselves. And you're getting pretty sunburned." Paul put his arm around her waist and nuzzled her damp pink neck. "You want to go back to the hotel? Maybe take a nap in the air conditioning?" Beth smiled. "Let's just check out this last row back here before we go, okay?" She handed him her go cup, the warm dregs sloshing in the bottom. Paul suppressed a sigh and dutifully disposed of what remained of their monsoons in a nearby trash can. His attention snagged on a crumbling crypt. "Hey, Beth, check this one out." The metal door was broken and hung off its hinges at an odd angle, pieces of the rusty lock strewn across the stone steps in front. "Spooky," Beth said. "Can you see inside?" "Not really," he squinted. "No, it's too dark in there." "Hey, look at this one." She led him further down the fragmented walkway to an elaborate marble tomb. Pointing at a statue of an inconsolably weeping angel draped over a sarcophagus, she said, "Isn't that beautiful? How cool would it be if we got a family crypt after we're married?" "That'd be awesome," he agreed, "but I think we'd have to take care of a few other priorities first, like maybe paying for the wedding." She pulled him into the sparse shade at the side of the mausoleum and kissed him. "You're so practical. That's one of the things I love about you, honey." "Whoa, what's this here? Can't be having none of that lovey-dovey stuff in the cemetery, you lovebirds, you." The man had appeared out of nowhere, a stained black too-short t-shirt stretched tight across his hairy belly. Ripped black pants hung from a rope belt, the white skin of one thigh showing through, a pair of two small flip-flops on his yellow-nailed feet. His bloated, talon-tipped fingers raised a near-empty port-of-call go-cup to his lips, a small smear on the rim the exact shade of lipstick Beth was wearing. He drained it in one greedy swallow. Ah, dat's more better. I do love me dem monsoons for true. He swiped a dirty hand across his mouth, his red eyes gleaming. Hey, girlie, what you got round your neck, you? Beth reached for Paul's hand. It's just a locket, she said. All right, then, that ain't no kind of cross, no, he muttered to himself. The man tossed the white plastic cup on the ground at their feet. Whoopsie, can't litter here, none, no, plenty, plenty rules. Hey, boy, why don't you fetch me up that, you? Paul hesitated, then slowly bent to retrieve the cup. Fast as a great blue heron spearing a crappie in the bayou, the man's arm shot out and grabbed Paul by the neck. He shook him once and flung him against the crib, where he lay like another of the crumbled leaves fallen haphazardly on the narrow cemetery path, his head twisted around at an impossible angle. Come here, Cher, you. His other arm seized Beth's wrist with superhuman strength and yanked her to him before she realized what was happening. The marble angel carried on with her perpetual lamentations.
Wow. Where did that scene come from? Did you actually visit any of these cemeteries in New Orleans? I heard that they're just really creepy and full of potential ideas.
Yes.
For these and, kind of stories.
Yes. Actually, this scene is based on something I experienced. Now, of course, it's, you know, horrified up, and I made the guy, you know, kind of supernatural Cajun man. But yeah, we did have a little situation with somebody we met in a cemetery once, and they are spooky places.
Yeah, no, I do agree with that. I mean, just envisioning that angel, you know, in you know, collapsed over a crypt in you know, in the depths of grief. Oh my gosh, what kind of statue is that?
That
that
is
would,
a bit
that alone would make me go, oh, I don't know.
That is an actual statue, and it is quite
Isn't it?
beautiful. Yes, it's gorgeous.
Wow.
It's just the epitome of grief.
Yeah. So that's a teaser for sure. That gives the reader a lot to go by. But I have one question. Did you have trouble writing the Cajun dialect that you just read? Like, did you have to study it at all? Did you have to listen to people talking? I'm very curious about that, because it's a very interesting type of dialogue to write, and it could be very challenging as well.
Well, I am a student of languages. I love learning new languages. I love hearing them spoken. And I treat the languages that I hear around me here in New Orleans as foreign languages. So I really pay attention when I hear somebody speaking that I, you know, in a dialect that I'm not used to. So it was pretty easy for me to write because I do pay attention to things like that.
That's wonderful, because I would struggle with that. You know, I mean, I could do the New York, but pretty good, you know, and the Brooklynese, you know,
Yeah.
but not the Cajun Bayou stuff. So, oh, wonderfully done, wonderfully done. Did you have any parts of the book that you felt you struggled with a lot? Like, some people talk about, you know, the middle, you know, where it's just, you know, they have trouble connecting the beginning to the end, and they have the, you know, the muddled middle. Could you talk about any of that, if you had any of those struggles?
Sure. I actually did struggle with the ending. because I had written an ending that I really, really loved, whereby I kill off one of the main characters. And I do have beta readers in my critique groups. I belong to a few different critique groups. And everyone did not want this character to die. So I had to resurrect him and write a whole new ending, but I saved that ending for the sequel.
Interesting. So it was every single beta reader?
Pretty much. Yeah.
All
No,
right.
nobody wanted
All
to see this guy die.
right. Okay. And so how did that delay you at all with your manuscript?
Well, I wasn't on a timeline, so
Okay.
it didn't
All
make
right.
any difference. I was just writing it for fun.
Where did you get the idea for this book?
Ah, so my neighbor here, my actual real life neighbor, is a
His name isn't Richard, is
no.
it? Okay.
However, he is in real life an elderly gentleman who was a private investigator.
Okay.
And we went to dinner one night, and he likes to tell me stories about, his private investigator days, and as a writer, I love to hear them. And he was telling me about one person who came up to him one day and said, "Does this look like a stab wound to you?" And
Okay.
that stuck in my head, and I immediately whipped out my phone and wrote that down. I was like, that is the first line of my book. Now, it didn't end up being the first line because I had to shuffle things around a little bit, but if you read the book, you will recognize that line is definitely in there.
Oh yeah, no, I remember that. That was Candy, right?
Yes, exactly.
Yes. And so before we get to the other excerpt, I just want to tell you that the bantering between Candy and Richard just had me laughing out loud. It was really funny. And my husband's like, "Why are you laughing? You sound like a crazy woman." Because, we're each listening to our own stuff in bed, at night, and I'm cackling, and he's like, "Why are you laughing?" Happy. So I just want you to know that really had me going for, and I just really felt like connected to the book because of those characters. All your characters are wonderful.
Oh, thank
Even the bad ones, even the ones that were like, they were still very evocative and attention getting and kept the story going. And
Cool.
that's important. Even the evil people were good. So
I had the most fun writing the evil ones.
isn't that the truth?
Yeah.
I don't know. I think we have, so let's hear your second excerpt, and then after you finish with that, we can start thinking about taking some questions.
Okay.
All right.
I'm glad that you threw in there that you were laughing at parts of the book because this next one is a little gruesome. It is also a little tongue in cheek, but just trigger warning. All right. Also, I was asked to read something at our local library for Halloween. So I took this chapter and I just tweaked it a little bit to make it a standalone Halloween story. And I've left it like that for this reading. It's called Love and Hair. The long dreadlocks splayed out over the checkered floor tiles like snakes trying to escape the blue tarp. David fingered the woolly hair. "What a waste," he said aloud to the empty room. Helen's drained body was destined for the furniture stripper's vat of caustic chemicals, but he was loath to consign those cool dreads to being dissolved into nothingness as well. A pang of some indefinable emotion lodged where his heart used to be. She was gone now. He nudged the body with his foot. David had never been able to grow his hair that long, and now that he'd been changed, well, it just wasn't going to happen. He'd envied her hair from that first moment. The night had been magical, colored lights swirling over the mob of dancers. The beautiful girl with the long hair had turned and locked eyes with him from across the room. No, I should think of something else. What should I do today? His thoughts switched back to a clearing in an Amazonian jungle, small brown men cavorting around a fire. Gourds of chicha passed reverently hand to hand, rhythmic pounding on deer-hide drums, and those awesome shrunken heads. He straightened and considered the body on the floor with a newfound gleam in his eye. Maybe a little experiment before I'm due at the neighborhood Halloween party. Helen won't mind. Boredom was an ever-present enemy, and talking to oneself was common among his kind, even in a city as vibrant and changeable as New Orleans. David twisted the head off the neck easily. Just to be sure, he'd make a run to the furniture stripper tomorrow. One more day wouldn't matter, but he turned up the air conditioning just in case. He studied the head in his hands. The mouth hung open slightly, and the brown eyes were half closed, as if lightly dozing. The long coveted dreadlocks cascaded through his hands. The Shuar chieftain had been a bit agitated when David dropped from the forest canopy into the middle of their ceremony. The whole tribe had thought he was a devil. Close, but no cigar, he chuckled to himself. It had taken some persuasion to get the chief to demonstrate the technique in detail. David appreciated the artistry of the process. His long existence had bequeathed him a recognition of good craftsmanship in all its many forms. Those sorts of pursuits helped to alleviate the tedium of his very lengthy existence in the world. In his apartment now, he slit the scalp up the back of the skull with a sharp kitchen knife and carefully peeled it and the face from the bone. He trimmed the torn skin at the neck with kitchen scissors. It was difficult keeping the long hair out of the way, but he did his best, intent on saving those beautiful dreads. Next, he turned the face inside out like a rubber mask and used a soup spoon to scrape into a mixing bowl the pieces of flesh and eyeball still attached on the inside. Quite sloppy in there, he giggled, licking the spoon. He set the mixing bowl aside for later. Righting the skin again, he pierced Helen's luscious, pillowy lips with three straight pins he found in the junk drawer. He then secured them shut by entwining string around the pins in a figure-eight pattern. He took care suturing the eyelids shut. The Shuar tribe believed sewing the eyes and mouth closed ensured the spirit of the dead would remain trapped inside the skull. David liked that idea. "Hello, Helen? Anyone home?" he asked with mock innocence. He then put on Sting's Moon Over Bourbon Street to set the mood. He felt peaceful, puttering around the kitchen, his mind at rest while his hands were busy. David decided he quite liked doing crafts. Maybe he'd try scrapbooking next. Out on the patio, he put two large crab pots on the gas grill, one filled with sand and a smooth flat rock from the garden, the other with water. He placed some cypress fronds in the water for their tannic acid, adding a box of black tea bags for good measure. Next, he carefully gathered the long hair and secured it with a rubber band. He dropped the head, now really just a face and scalp with hair, into the boiling water. The Shuar chieftain had been adamant that this was the tricky part. Boil a head too long and all the hair would fall out. Boil it for too short a period of time and you're stuck with a mushy, gelatinous mess. He set a timer for half an hour, stirring the sand and the rock in the other pot with a big wooden pizza paddle so it would be uniformly hot. Crafting is so relaxing, he thought. I don't believe I've felt this peaceful in centuries. When he pulled the head from the boiling water by its dreadlocks, he immediately saw that it was much reduced in size. The misshapen ears were still unmistakably very small ears on a very small head. He blotted it with paper towels, then placed it in the other crab pot, covering it with the hot sand. The chieftain had been reluctant to explain this important step too, but after David tore apart three of his tribesmen, he'd been more open-minded about sharing the information. Getting the hot sand into the hard-to-reach eye sockets and nasal cavity was an important part of the drying process and took some finesse. Back in the kitchen, he draped the now dry face and scalp over a grapefruit to hold the shape and began smoothing the skin with the hot, flat rock. Helen had always had beautiful skin. When the rock cooled and he'd done all he could there, David removed the rubber band from the hair and shook the luxurious dreadlocks into place. He was quite pleased with his first attempt. He'd have to do it again. Now, where to display my creation, he considered. Maybe the front window with the pumpkins. Helen always enjoyed decorating for the holidays. David hung the head in the window and stepped back to admire his work. Perfect. He checked his watch. Up next, Halloween cookies for the neighbors. He clapped his hands in delight before retrieving the mixing bowl he'd set aside earlier. An hour later, Christie's new neighbor stood on her front steps, a plate of cookies in his hand. Hi, David. I'm so glad you could come. Christie swung her waist-length, silky blonde hair to one side as she held the door open. Monster Mash and the sound of clinking glasses and laughter wafted out into the night air. Come on in and meet everyone. I like your cape. David handed her the plate. I think you're going to like these, he said. There's a secret ingredient. He stepped over the threshold. Oh, and I've got to say, he paused, I love your hair.
Oh, so you read this at a library?
Yes.
Yeah. So what was it like to read it live in front of people? Do you have enough vision to see their faces and their reactions and stuff?
Well, I couldn't see their faces, but they were gasping in parts and they were laughing in other parts. So it was
Right,
very
right.
gratifying.
Oh, yeah. How gross and intriguing at the same time.
Lot of research went into that.
Yeah, where did you find this stuff about the shrunken heads?
Oh, it's amazing what you can find online.
Oh, wow. Wow. Wonderfully read, by the way. Wonderfully read. Yeah. So we're going to take some questions now. If anybody has a question, just say your name and ask your question, and we'll get started.
Hi, this is Nell.
Hey,
Hi,
Nell.
Nell.
Hi. I wanted to ask, have you thought about reading your book, Sue? You do such an excellent job at it. I mean, even with the Creole or the patois, you did a very good job.
Oh, thank you. I have not thought about doing it myself. I don't feel I write, I read well aloud. I feel like maybe I just read this better because I had already read it. But it is kind of expensive, I know, to hire people. And there's so many characters in this book and so many different voices. So maybe I should consider doing it myself.
Yeah. I think maybe you should. It was a wonderful reading.
Thank you.
Yeah. Anyone else?
This is Marlene. How do you become an extroverted introvert, or an intro, whichever way it goes?
I couldn't tell you. It just kind of happened. I was always very, very shy. And then I guess it was after I had my son. I was probably in my late 20s, maybe early 30s, when I looked around and realized that shy people do not have as much fun as extroverted people. And I started making a concerted effort to push myself and to put myself in situations where I would have to interact with people more. And, fake it till you make it. It gets easier and easier.
So, do you
This is
really
Keisha.
have?
Can you go now?
Oh, go ahead, Keisha. Go ahead, Keisha.
Kate
Sorry, this
has
is Keisha.
a go.
Congratulations. Congratulations to you. And I was wondering, how long did it take you to write it?
That's hard to say because I work on a couple of different things all at the same time. That's one reason why I feel I never have writer's block, because when I get stuck on one thing, I'll just start working on the other thing or continue working on it. But I'm going to say maybe 2 years and then another year just shopping it around to different publishers and counting up my rejections.
Kate has a question.
Go ahead, Kate.
Okay, I'm wondering, thank you. This has been an excellent presentation. I'm wondering, what is the cover of your book? How you got the cover? And if you're doing a sequel, how will you follow up that cover?
Okay, so the cover is actually a photograph. I had a very clear vision, no pun intended, as to what I wanted on the cover. And that was one of the sticking points with the other publisher that we talked about earlier. They wanted to have an in-house artist do it, and they really don't give the author a lot of input. Whereas the publisher I eventually went with was like, work something up and show it to me and we'll talk about it. And he loved it. I went to a cemetery and I took a whole bunch of photos with my phone. And then I submitted it to him and he had his a graphic artist do the lettering. So it's a black and white photo of an angel up, a statue of an angel up front. And in the background are tombs and crypts with crosses on the top, and gets a little fuzzy going back further. And then the lettering is kind of in a, I guess you'd call it a Gothic script. Some blood drips on the S.
Oh, yes.
So that's what it looks like. And the sequel, I really did not write this and I didn't end it initially thinking that there would be a sequel. I just saved that one last chapter because I loved it so much. But I've had a lot of people ask me about it. So I started thinking, and the characters are still talking to me. So I'm continuing on.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Kate.
Hi, this is Lisa, and I was wondering what's marketing your book been like for you? And also, did you write before you lost your vision? Did you write stories or whatever?
No, I can't. I mean, I wrote a couple of little things here and there, but I definitely was not serious about my writing. And I don't even know that I've ever really done a full short story, just little bits and pieces here and there before I started developing vision loss. But the marketing aspect of it is the next to submissions, that's it's the least favorite part of it for me. You have to kind of go around to different bookstores and beg. Well,
It feels
you
like that, doesn't it?
it does. It
Yeah.
does. And I mean, I have to say that I live in a great town for this because everyone here, including bookstore owners, are very, very supportive of local authors.
Right.
So it was, I got off relatively easy. And I also I had a big book launch party where I sold out of every book I brought with me. But that was mostly
Wonderful.
it was one of the best days of my life, not because I sold all my books, but because everybody was there to have fun and support me, and it was really a wonderful day. But I'm
Yeah.
including that in the marketing of it also.
Yeah. The people that are listening to you saying that are probably nodding their heads, going, yep. Yep. Yeah. Marketing sucks. Yep.
Yes, it does.
Yeah. It is one of those necessary things we do that is just, I wish that marketing could be less stressful and more amenable to what we want as authors, which is just to have people know about our books, right?
Yes.
That's why we write and we publish, because we want people to read our books.
Well, it used to be that way, right? I mean, Hemingway would write and then he would ship it off to his publisher and they would do everything. It's not.
Yeah, that's not what I want. That's why I independently publish, is because I want more control over my book. But it sounds like your publisher really does have your best interests in mind, and they really do support you as the author. And that's wonderful.
It is wonderful. I mean, the downside of going with a very small publisher is obviously that, you're not going to get as much in the publicity and marketing area. But I'm trying to do that. I'm looking at different book fairs now in the spring and different things like that. If I can make it fun, I'll do it. But if I go and it's horrible, I'm not doing anymore.
Understandable. Yeah. Understandable. Anyone else have questions for Sue?
This is Nell again. I was
Yeah.
wondering if you have a mailing list or an email newsletter. I am like the newsletter queen. I love newsletters. I was wondering if you have one.
I do not. The thought of a newsletter actually makes my blood run cold, just like a weekly column. I don't want to have that kind of pressure on me at this point in my life. So, no, I'm sorry. The answer is I don't have a newsletter and I'm not considering one.
Anyone else?
Thanks.
Any other questions? All righty. So Sue, I have a couple of questions based on what you gave me about your bio. So I want to know if you really do have a tortoise named Gordon Ramsay.
I do. He's a redfoot tortoise, and
Oh.
his name is Gordon Ramsay because he's always been all about the food.
How old is he?
I'm not sure. I estimate him to be between 7 and 9 years old.
Okay.
But he's actually he's got a personality on him.
They do.
Yeah. And he will come to the French Quarter with me occasionally. He has a stroller. And
How big is he? How many pounds does he weigh?
I haven't weighed him, but I need two hands to pick him up, and I
Oh,
guess
he's a big boy. Yeah.
he's about maybe 12 or 14 inches long.
Oh my goodness, yes.
He's heavy.
You
But people
have him
know
in a
him.
stroller?
Yes, people know him. And the
My
last time
goodness.
I took him into the French Quarter, we had him walking on the bar and people were feeding him pizza, which
Oh my goodness.
I
That's
didn't
not good
realize.
for
No,
turtles.
I didn't realize that at the time and I stopped it, but he was gobbling that up.
I
He was
bet.
having a great time.
Gotta feed him some lettuce.
Yeah. Oh, he eats very, very well.
Oh my goodness. That's fine. I funny short sidebar. I had a paratransit driver that loved his turtles, and he was just turtle crazy. And he would just, every time you talk about his turtles, he would be just glowing about his turtles. I'm like, that is interesting, because I never knew people could like really admire their turtles as pets. And He said, yeah, they talk to him, they bob their heads, they make eye contact, they do all that. And I'm like, I had no idea.
Yes, there's a lot going on there. And I think that's one of the draws for me. I mean, I love all animals. I've always had dogs and cats and birds and everything. Right now I just have the tortoise. But the draw for me with the reptiles, I think, is that you don't expect them to have that kind of interactive intelligence. And when you see it, it's surprising and it's fascinating. So that's the deal for me.
Well, that's something for you to maybe one day incorporate into your writing. You never know.
I think there will be a tortoise in this sequel.
So why did you name him Gordon Ramsay?
Because he's all about the food.
I wonder what Gordon Ramsay would think of that.
I do not know.
So is there anything else you'd like to share with us tonight about your writing, or about the process itself? Are you an outliner? Are you a pantser? Are you what I call a tweener, which is a little bit of both?
So, I am very, very definitely in the pantser group. I sat down to write this only because I had that initial first line, "Does this look like a stab wound to you?" And I just sat down and I typed that out, and the words just started coming, and Candy started talking to me, and then Richard started talking to me, and all I had to do was type fast enough to write down what they were saying. And pretty much the whole book went like that. And I realized that is not usual for most writers, and I can only hope that this second book goes like that too. But yeah, I'm definitely a pantser. I wish I could have an outline because it would be nice to know what's going to happen. But I'm always being surprised. Like I'll write a paragraph, and then I'll sit there and I'll read through and I'll say, well, what if this happened? And that's the way I wrote the entire book. And very, very rarely did I ever like write myself into a corner. Where I had to say, oh no, this isn't going anywhere, and then back myself out. Most of the time it just flowed. And
That's wonderful to hear.
other than that, I usually write in the morning, before the coffee kicks in, before the dreams are, the cobwebs are from my mind. I write best when I'm half awake. But I'm too tired to write at night, so I have a small window of opportunity every morning.
Yeah, I've heard that. I mean, I also have that kind of when I first get up and I sit down and everything is fresh and new. I have a couple of hours where it flows, and then I get distracted by all the other things and activities that life has.
Yeah.
And then I can't, I try to go back to it. Sometimes I can, most of the time I can't,
Right.
and that's
Yeah.
just the way it works.
Well, there's always
So,
laundry to be done, right? Or
yes,
dishes to be washed.
oh yes, for sure. Oh, I was going to ask you something that just went out of my head. So what do you use? You use, I mean, you said you have some vision loss. Do you use magnification on your computer? What do you use in terms of making things more accessible to you as you write?
I use magnification at this point. I can get things, to a decent size on my laptop where I can read them. I can't read physical books anymore, but I can still, the largest print on my Kindle is, I read everything on my Kindle now.
Oh, understood. Do you have any other assistive technology at your disposal, like digital screen enlargement, like a CCTV or anything like that?
I do have that, but I can't even imagine reading a whole book sitting up in my kitchen, you know. I kind of read laying on the couch or before I go to sleep at night. That seems like it would be very, very awkward, but it probably is in my future. So,
Well, maybe you'll move it to a different place
this is
and be
Lisa.
more
I have a
comfortable.
question.
Hey, Lisa.
What kind of books do you like to read? You said you didn't really like, horror. So what do you read? I will read anything, except really, I'm not a big science fiction reader and like straight romance. I just can't, I need a little bit more to keep me interested. And as a matter of fact, there is a scene or two in my book where I have two characters who are in love, and there's a scene where they're talking in bed, and that was hard for me to write, because I didn't want to write a sex scene, and I didn't want to make it graphic in any kind of way. It just made me very uncomfortable to think about that. So I had to make it interesting, but I still wanted to convey the sense that these were two people who were deeply in love. And that scene took me a while to write. But I do read mystery. I read thriller. I'll read biographies, memoir. I read nonfiction too. Pretty much a little bit of everything.
Deanna has her hand up. Deanna? Go
Sorry
ahead.
for coming in late. As everybody knows, I'm a 24/7 caregiver, so my time is never my own. But I did download your book from Audible, and I was intending to try to read some of it this week. The title intrigued me. I'm not into paranormal stuff, but I grew up with it all around me, so but to me that was normal, not paranormal. So I just wanted to say that I do intend to read your book, and if I like it, I'll give it a rave review. And
Wow.
if I don't like it, I'll tell you why.
Thank you,
But
Deanna.
because sometimes critiquing is just as valuable as, the rave review will help you sell books. But that's one of the things that I get a lot out of being part of this organization from the get-go, is I'm a shy person, and when I send things out, they get published, but it's like pulling teeth to get me brave enough to send it anywhere except to the list, for people that I'm not afraid of to look at it.
Yes. Critique groups are so important.
So anyway, I just wanted to say that I did buy the book. I just haven't had a chance to stand still long enough to read it. I sometimes feel like a hamster on a running wheel. And if I have to sit down, I'm like you. If I have an idea, I've got to do something with it, even if it's chanting a poem for the 16 block walk to the dentist office that was coming together in my head so that I'd remember it long enough to have time to write it down.
Oh boy.
So,
Thanks, Deanna.
yeah, everybody has a different style, and there's no right way to do this stuff. You just have to go with what works for you.
Yes. I have a question for those of you who did read the book on Audible. How does that sound? I mean, there are so many different accents in the book. Do they come across at all?
I'll tell you when I've had a chance to read it for sure. Is
Okay,
I
thanks.
don't like it when a narrator or interpreter of a written work mispronounces names and you know, because they've got a Cajun character or they've got a Hispanic character, and they don't bother to take the time to actually learn how a foreign word sounds.
Yes.
That grates on my nerves, so I'll give you an honest one on that one.
Okay, thanks.
So, Sue, this is Annie. I've read your book with Kindle, in the Kindle reader, and I didn't have any problems with it. I mean, I read it with the with the default voice that was on it, and it did pretty good. So,
Okay, good.
yeah. I mean, I also could probably have read it with my Voice Dream Reader app, because it lets you import Kindle books into it, and then you can choose voices from there. It's another app that I use, but I didn't have any problems, and I thought it was fine. So.
Excellent. Yeah, I don't know how all of this works, but it's lovely to hear that there's so much assistive technology out there
Yeah.
for
Oh
that.
yeah. No, yeah. If
And
it's in on Amazon or Kindle, or even Audible, we can get to it. So
yeah,
yeah.
and we can also I can get the ebook and have my Echo device read it to me while I'm rushing around doing things. So
Yes.
that's another option if people want to read books that aren't available on Bookshare or on Bard, because only one of my two books is on Bard as yet, and I'm working on my third book now. So we'll see if I get brave enough to, to actually get it published. This, yeah.
You will. You will. Don't worry. Have faith. All
Well, Leonard is
right.
in, and that and Group One are the ones that keep me working on actually putting my stuff out there, because they tell me like it is, and I appreciate it, even when I'm all messed up with my grammar, Marcy, Marcia, and Cleora. If you don't understand how I got where I ended up.
Yeah. So, I have one more question, Sue. Thanks, Deanna. Before we conclude. So you mentioned beta readers. And I have a couple of questions about that. How did you get turned on to beta readers, and how do you where do you find your beta readers?
I had been I when I moved down here, okay, well, let me back up. When I lived in New York, I had become part of a critique group, and I had a wonderful experience. There were five, four or five of us, four core group, and we met every single week for about 10 years with only a couple of missed sessions. Everybody was so committed. And just got wonderful feedback, to the point where I now have these voices in my head that are not mine. So I can read something and say, oh, no, Kim would have said this about that. I got to change that, or, whatever. And it's wonderful. The most important thing I would say, though, is make sure your beta readers read your genre. Because if you are writing, for example, horror, and your beta readers are used to reading romance, it's not a good fit. You're not going to get the feedback that you need. And that was something I had to learn early on.
Thank you for that tip. So do you have anything else you'd like to share with us before we go to our closing remarks?
I just thank you for this opportunity to talk about my book. I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, so did I. Wonderful stuff. Lisa, do you have Lisa is behind our eyes president. She usually closes us out. Lisa, would you like to share
Sure.
anything?
Sure. Thank you so much, Sue, for talking about your book, and congratulations about your book. And I hope a lot of people who read your genre reads it. And just thank you. And now I'm going to talk a little bit about Behind Our Eyes. So we have pilots to welcome new members, and we have a main email list that people submit their works and get comments from other people, and we try to be respectful of each other on that list. We also have two other email lists, a genre list, and each month is a different genre. This month it's novel writing, and we also have marketing lists. Each critique group usually has their own list as well. We have quite a few critique groups that meet usually once a month. We have Sunday night programs twice a month. Sometimes we have speakers who speak about a certain topic on writing, and sometimes we have critique sessions. Sometimes we have just like sort of like a party where we all read our poems and stories on a particular topic. We're going to do that for our Thanksgiving gala. There are Friday write-ins, which people get together and they say what they want to accomplish in an hour, and then they come back and report whether they've accomplished things. To just get some support. And we also have once a month submission parties that is on Zoom and on the conference line. We have writers exchange classes that someone in the group will be willing to teach a class, and it's free. Some of them are one time like seminar, and then some of them last for a few weeks. We have published three anthologies, and we are working on a fourth one. We also have our magazine, Magnets and Ladders, that is published twice a year on the internet, and people can submit their poetry and prose and nonfiction to Magnets and Ladders. There is a August 15th date for the like deadline for the fall and winter one, and I think it is it. February, or is anybody? I don't think Mary Jo is on the call
February
anymore.
15th.
What?
February 15th for
Yeah,
the
that's what I
spring
thought. I can
summer.
hardly hear you, but February 15th, that's what I thought it was. Deadline. We also have once a month readers workshop, which is has a different person who MCs it, and we get together and read poems and short fiction and get comments on our reading of our piece rather than on the piece itself, so we can practice reading in front of people. If I missed anything, someone can remind me what I missed. Okay, so I just want to thank everyone for being here. Thank you, Annie, for interviewing, and thank you again, Sue, for being here. So, unless you have anything more, Annie, I will say good night.
Good night, everybody. Thank you,
Night.
Sue.
Thank
Thanks,
you.
Lisa.
Good night.